Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and an extraordinary election is unfolding in Iran, where millions of impassioned voters are casting ballots to determine whether a hardline conservative president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, gets a second 4 years in office, or whether his main challenger, the pro-reform former prime minister, Mir Hussein Mousavi, is catapulted into office on a recent wave of support from young people and intellectuals. The winner will play a key role in responding to President Obama's overtures to Iran and in the dispute over Iran's nuclear program. So how's it going? Joining us from Tehran is Borzu Daragahi, Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Borzu, what are you seeing? We're hearing reports of huge lines at the polls.
Absolutely. The turnout is extraordinary. The key is, will the urbanites and middle-class voters who support Mir Hussein Mousavi muster up enough votes to cancel out the massive support that President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has among the lower classes and the rural folks who have been the beneficiaries of his populist economic policies and who identify with his scrappy values and demeanor?
Well, we hear in reports today that Ahmadinejad's supporters are like American evangelicals. They may be smaller in number, but they go out and vote. But what does this election really mean, Borzu? Because we understand that the hardline clerics really rule Iran. So if Mousavi does manage to win, is it because they let him?
Well, I think that's an oversimplification. The clerics are divided as everyone else in Iran. As a matter of fact, it seems like most of the clergy are now trending towards Mousavi versus Ahmadinejad because they're offended by his messianic rhetoric and his claims to have direct contact with the hidden imam and all this. There is a supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. He does have a large say on matters of national security. Maybe he even has veto power. But on big decisions such as the nuclear issue, such as the relations with the West, he rules by consensus.
Well, more on how it's going today. We understand that the government-owned cell phone text messaging network is down. Are people complaining about the voting? Are there people protesting or saying there might be signs of fraud?
Well, I think the SMS service being down, it actually is a disadvantage to Ahmadinejad because he's been the one who's been using it to blast people with propaganda against the former prime minister. But I think that if it is down on purpose, I think the security forces are really worried. And I know they are because I've been in communication with some people in the security apparatus who say that they are very worried about one candidate or the other winning or losing and then people going out in the street and then brawls erupting. And then, you know, this is how things happen in the Middle East. People SMSing their buddies and they come in with their motorcycles and get into a fight. So maybe it's a good thing that they cancel the SMS services.
Well, and you have said to us that no matter what happens, that this election has unleashed something that will be hard to put back in the bottle. What do you mean?
Well, there's two dimensions to that. The period of campaigning, Iranians were out night after night in a amazing display of public protest, public support for political candidates. They were debating each other on street corners, things you haven't seen in Iran in 30 years. There's also something more that I think is going to be even tougher than that to put back in the genie bottle, because you can always use the truncheon to get those people off the street. There was a huge rift here between the president and other forces in the government that was made public. And they started accusing each other of corruption and of lying. And you never saw anything like that ever in Iran. And it created a level of transparency and it opened up the space for debate. It's like, hey, if that guy can call the president a liar, I sure can. If that guy can say that every single person who was one of the pillars of the revolution is a corrupt mafia boss, I certainly can. And it just created a kind of a dynamic that's going to be tough to put back in the genie bottle.
Huh. We're reading that there was a 26-year-old doctoral student in sociology who reportedly watched President Obama's grassroots campaign last year from his parents' Tehran apartment and then brought those tactics to Mousavi's campaign and had created what some are calling the Obama effect for the challenger. Do you see that?
No. But what I do see is that President Barack Obama lowered the temperature in the Middle East. He came here and he spoke in Cairo and he made an address on the Persian New Year to the Iranian people. And he pulled the rug out from hardliners in Iran, in Lebanon, in Afghanistan. And he created a space for moderates to emerge and voice their concerns and opinions without being tarred as American Zionist collaborators. And in that sense, that's what I would describe as the Obama effect. As a matter of fact, it was Ahmadinejad who uses the slogan, yes, we can, in his billboards.
Borzu Dargahi, Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times in Tehran, on a very suspenseful, is that the word you'd use, Dave Borzu?
Sure.
Borzu, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Well, it's a Friday, long week, so let's go way, way back to the outfield of a ballpark in New York City on the afternoon of October 3rd, 1951.
Bobby Thompson up there swinging. He's had two out of three, a single and a double, and Billy Kraft is playing him right on the third baseline. One out, last of the ninth. Bracker throws. There's a long pass! It's going to be, I believe! The Giants run the pellet! 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 Bobby Thompson hits into the lower deck of the left field stand. The Giants run the pellet, and they're going crazy! They're going crazy!
And they're still going crazy. That's announcer Russ Hodges calling the shot heard round the world, New York Giants third baseman Bobby Thompson's historic walk-off home run against the Brooklyn Dodgers in the winner-take-all playoff game for the National League pennant. It's a moment that's been immortalized in writing by Don DeLillo, John Steinbeck, Jack Kerouac, Philip Roth. The film The Godfather referenced it. So did Woody Allen and his girlfriend in the film Deconstructing Harry.
Wow. Baseball signed by the 1951 Giants.
Really? That's
yeah,
so
look.
Great. The 51
Bobby
Giants
Thompson.
Were the,
yeah,
the one
there it
genuine
is.
Miracle of my lifetime. That's so great. When he hit that home run, that was the only hint I've ever had that there may be a God. That's so new. What'd you think of that?
It was easy.
But what happened to the ball Bobby Thompson hit? That question became an obsession for our next guest, who spent years trying to find what's been called baseball's holy grail. Thompson drove it to the left field, section 35 of the Polo Grounds. Several people, including Brian Beagle's father, believe they have it. Leland's, the sports auction house, is still offering $1 million for it. Could it be that the ball's secrets are locked in a convent in New Mexico? Brian Beagle's new book and documentary film are both called Miracle Ball, My Hunt for the Shot Heard Round the World. It's part CSI, part loony ESPN talk show, and thoroughly entertaining. And Brian joins us from the Argo Studios in New York. Welcome.
Thanks, Robin. Thank you for having me.
And are we hearing a little hyperbole here? You know, adults in your film call this the greatest sports mystery of all time, not just the Holy Grail, the Magna Carta, the Constitution. Why is it so important?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. And I think it was the drama of that game itself combined with the fact that, you know, 1951 was the first year that many people got TVs in their homes.
Mm-hmm.
And people didn't have to imagine what a ball game looked like, you know, by listening to it on the radio anymore. They can watch it live.
This was baseball's first nationally broadcast major league game.
Correct. And it was like something from a Hollywood script, the way it was set up. Bottom of the ninth, one out, two men on. They needed three runs to win the game. And up steps Thompson and you just played the radio call
right.
That still sends chills down my spine.
Right. Sports Illustrated says it was the number two sports event of the 20th century, right behind the U.S. Olympic hockey team beating the Soviets in that 1980 game in Lake Placid. Well, you go on a search for the ball because of your dad. And here's where this, you know, sort of entertaining CSI story also becomes, oh, I don't know, what, Willie Loman through Hamlet. Because your dad is one tough customer who almost desperately believes he has the ball. Let's listen.
Now you look at this ball. You tell me the commissioner's name right over here. You can see Willie Mays' rookie year and the ball players that I mentioned. This is the ball, the shot heard around the world. I don't care what anyone says.
Well, I don't want to get too, you know, psychoanalytical here, but I mentioned Willie Loman and Hamlet. You know, did you want to prove him wrong? Did you feel for him? And It must have been weighing on you that he wanted this to be the ball, the one that he bought in a Salvation Army store in Queens.
Yeah, it was an extremely emotional time of my life. I did at first want to prove that he had the baseball because I know that he firmly believed that he had the real baseball. But the further I went in the search, so many miraculous events occurred that made me start to doubt that he had the real baseball. And it came more about a search for the truth for me.
Huh. Well, that search led to you to a couple of New York City forensic detectives, Dan Austin and Henry Rogan. You take them PAFCO at the wall. That's the famous Daily News photo of Brooklyn Dodger left fielder Andy PAFCO watching as Thompson's home run heads into the stands. We have a clip from your film as they examine the photo and look at one man in particular. Could he be catching the ball?
All right, look at him.
Yeah, you see
look at both his hands. Look at his left hand.
Yeah, he's got something in his left hand. It's very intriguing.
Either he's got a really big left hand or he's got a glove. Okay. Now, do you see the white mark there?
I see a
white
mark.
Do you suppose that could be the ball?
Well, meanwhile, Brian, I'm looking at that and I'm thinking, I think it's a tissue. But it was so intense. And you later find out through some high-tech 3D digital imaging that that little white dot was, in fact, the ball. The man didn't catch it. But then a big break comes because the Daily News in New York is publicizing your cause and you start getting hundreds of tips. What are people saying to you?
Some people were trying to sell me junk from their attic. And I got a call from one gentleman named Norman Schimmel who remembered a passage in a book that he had read in 1953, which made mention of the fan who caught the ball. And the fact that Mr. Schimmel remembered this was yet again one of those remarkable strokes of luck.
Which is astonishing because it's reporter Tommy Holmes who wrote that book. And you also meet with another person named Irving Axe of Flushing, Queens, who was at that game. And first of all, you show him a photo of him in the stands. He calls his wife over to make sure it's him. Let's listen.
Red Jabs, they found me. Come here. Take a look. Confirm this. It's like an FBI thing over here.
An FBI thing. Yeah, that's the one I said.
Yeah, that's me.
That's your ear.
That's me.
Nobody else has an ear like that.
And Irving confirms for you that what he saw from the stands is reporter Tommy Holmes interviewing a woman after the game was over. When you find the book, you see that Tommy Holmes has actually given the name of this woman, Helen.
Right. Tommy Holmes wrote down the name of the person who caught the ball because he was the only reporter who ran up in the stands to try and find a story to write that would be different than any other reporter. So he went looking for the baseball and the fan, and he wrote down the name Helen, G-A-W-N, which turned out to be a red herring because she gave him a fake last name to protect her identity.
Because Helen had a secret. She wasn't even supposed to be at that baseball game. Brian Beagle is author of Miracle Ball, My Hunt for the Shot Heard Around the World. We'll have more in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to the story of Brian Beagle's hunt for the miracle ball, Bobby Thompson's shot heard around the world, the home run that beat the Brooklyn Dodgers in the 1951 National League Championship playoff game. And Brian, let's pick up this story, which is incredible. The New York Daily News is doing a big feature on your search for the ball at this point in the story. Two guys in New Jersey read about it. They get in touch with you. They tell you that the woman who you think may have caught the ball might have been a nun because they heard from a guy in a supermarket that the Thompson ball was in a convent in Lodi, New Jersey. You keep plugging away. You discover there was indeed a nun named Helen who might have been at the Polo Grounds that day and might have given sports writer Tommy Holmes a false name because she didn't have permission to be there.
Right. In that particular order, the Felician sisters, it's very strict, especially back in the 50s, and you would need special permission to be at a public event without wearing your habit.
Right.
And according to the nuns that I had talked to, there's no way she would have gotten that permission. So she would have had to sneak away from her convent to go to that baseball game.
So you were all following this at home. We now have a woman who was interviewed, who was in the stands. You were looking at the photographs. You find one woman who would have been right where the ball landed. You trace a woman named Helen all the way to a convent in New Mexico. Now, here's where you find that she changed her name to adopt the name of Saint Rita because, dun, 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 Saint Rita is who?
Saint Rita is the patron saint of achieving the impossible.
And you discover that she's also sort of become the patron saint of baseball players, that they actually wear medallions with a baseball player on it. At this point, Brian, in your film and book, I'm thinking, no, sir. I mean, it's just, it's amazing. So are you feeling at this point, I think I know what happened?
I am. I'm feeling that Sister Helen moved down to New Mexico from New York, changed her name to Sister Helen Rita, and she has this baseball hidden away in her convent for all these years.
Well, and so you have to tell your dad that it doesn't seem that the ball that he bought for $2 in a Salvation Army store is the right one. This is like telling Willie Loman, you know, you're not going to get your job back. That was the thing he was leaning on.
And he didn't take it very well at first. But as a little bit of time went by and I told him what I thought had happened, he conceded and he came over to my side and he gave me his blessing and he said, go find out where that ball is and who had it.
Well, what now, Brian? Is this really over for you? It seems as if there are still some doors open because the nuns in New Mexico told you that when Helen, Sister Rita, died, her belongings were given to her sister in California and her son says his mom might have thrown them away. So you never got your hands on the ball.
I'm satisfied in knowing the fan that walked out of the stadium with the baseball that day. Now, when you read the book, you'll see that there are two possible places it could have wound up. One of them was in a landfill in Monterey, California, which means the ball's gone forever. The other one is a scenario by which the ball could have been passed down to another person. Now, if that's the case, and someone comes forward with a baseball, I certainly have the means to either authenticate or not authenticate that they could have the real ball. But either way, the mystery is solved. We know who had the ball for 58 years.
Well, and I can still picture, you know, dozens of fans late at night digging in the dump in Monterey, California, still
Maybe.
Looking for it. That's Brian Beagle, author of Miracle Ball, My Hunt for the Shot Heard Around the World. For more, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. Brian, thanks so much for speaking with us about it.
Robin, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Well, joining us now, the man who hit that shot heard round the world, Bobby Thompson, 85 years old now, living in Savannah, Georgia. Bobby Thompson, do you think that Brian Beagle has it right? Do you think he did find out what happened to that ball?
It would be hard for me to feel he has it right. All I've got to give him all the credit in the world to keep after the darn thing. You know, he certainly deserves a lot of congratulations.
What does it mean to you? Are you one of those people that really, really, really wants to know?
No. You know what? I'm living down here in a beautiful place, and that's the least of my thoughts. You know, it's just enjoying life here with lots of friendly people and a place where I belong.
Do people still come up to you and talk about that shot heard around the world?
Yes, they do.
Well, and, you know, from the moment you hit it practically, people claimed that they had the ball. Tell us that story. You went into the locker room at one point, and there were how many balls sitting there?
Well, somebody, as I entered the Yankee Stadium the following day, a guy met me and had a ball in his hand. He said, Bobby, this is the ball you hit yesterday. I'd be glad to give it to you if you get me 2 tickets to today's game. Well, without even thinking, I said, whoa, stay right there. And I ran in the locker room and got hold of our locker room man. And Eddie Logan, our locker room guy, laughed at me. And I thought, well, what are you laughing at? He's standing out there with the ball. And he took me over to the chair in front of my locker, and there were about 8 so-called home run balls sitting on my chair. Well, so that was the end of that.
Right. Well, everybody's willing to hold up a ball and say, this is it. Well, if Brian Beagle is right, do you ever think about the possible poetic justice here? A nun potentially walks out of the Polo Grounds with your miraculous home run ball.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, I knew a group of nuns, and they were all great baseball fans, and it's funny. So for a nun to have traced this ball, it kind of tied it together for me, you mm-hmm. know, because I know nuns are wonderful women and very much interested in baseball.
Well, that's former New York Giants baseball great Bobby Thompson, who hit the shot heard round the world to steal the National League pennant from the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1951. Some people still haven't forgiven you.
I guess not.
Bobby, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Well, very nice talking to you. Thank you very much.
Okay, still ahead today, hate crimes are on the rise in the U.S. Why? That's after the latest news, here and now. Let's do some housekeeping. First, your thoughts, and boy, oh boy, oh boy, did we hear from you. After our talk with author Lenore Skenazy, also called the world's worst mom, after she granted her 9-year-old's wish and let him find his way home in Manhattan on the subway alone. Lenore claims that statistically kids are safer now than they've been in decades, and parents should allow them to free range. Well, Gordon Bach of Northfield, Vermont wrote, "As a city person who likely knows free range chickens only from their appearance on restaurant menus, Lenore is perhaps unaware that they sometimes end up in the belly of the fox." Emily Meebust of Allentown, Pennsylvania writes, "She reminds me of the rationalizations that some parents make for not vaccinating their children. The reason their kid is fine is because everyone else is vaccinating." Lynn Carraher of Crawfordsville, Indiana says, "I agree that it's good for kids to go off on their own more, but aren't they statistically safer because parents are so protective?" And we decided to call Caroline Cloutier of Keene, New Hampshire, because part of her email was in Latin. Caroline, you say Skenazy makes a too common logical fallacy?
Ad hoc ergo propter hoc.
Meaning?
Because two things happen together, I can make a conclusion about how they're related.
That's right. And you say just because something happens safely once doesn't mean it's a good idea to do it. I think you cited golf clubs.
Exactly. Statistically, it's unlikely to get hit by lightning if I wave a golf club in a rainstorm, but it still doesn't make it a good idea.
Well, Caroline, thank you so much. And we just wanted to say to you, vale. We're told in Latin that means be well, so be well.
Yes. Thank you.
Well, we want to note, Lenore Skenazy and her concept of free-range kids had supporters as well. Penny Burgett of Mountain View, Arkansas says, "I think children so cloistered are at risk of either engaging in very risky behaviors once they're on their own, or at risk of being afraid of the world." And Juan Ochoa of the town of Harvard, Massachusetts agreed. "When I was growing up in the 60s, he writes, the only hard and fast rule was to return home when my parents would blow a whistle. I was free to get covered with mud, get hurt, crash my bike, soar my balsa wood gliders off the cliffs, build forts, find frogs, get freezing. The point being to understand the consequences of my decisions, both bad and good." Okay, take care of a little more business here. A correction. We misspoke yesterday. We said the Spanish flu of 1918 was brought to the U.S. by returning World War I soldiers. Well, it was the other way around. Listener Mary Mendoza reminded us in a comment on the webpage that the 1918 pandemic started in the United States at Fort Riley, Kansas. The flu then traveled to Europe with those same soldiers and incubated in the dreadful conditions of the trenches in World War I before coming back. And we also want to share with you some of the many thoughts we received after our conversation with Miriam Kleiman. She'd been a patient of the murdered abortion provider Dr. George Tiller and said he provided a late-term abortion for her when no other doctors would. Well, we heard from many of you, including this call from Jeremy in Tempe, Arizona.
I stand behind this woman 100%. As a medical student, hopefully becoming a doctor someday, I'm appalled more by the amount of doctors who put their religious beliefs in the way of their practice. You know, when you become a doctor, you take an oath to serve your patients and ensure that, you know, their health and safety is the number one priority, not religious beliefs.
But Celeste Conover of San Diego wrote to say that her experience, while different, also inspired doctors. She says, of course, Dr. Tiller should not have been murdered, but she chose a different path when she found her fetus had a profound genetic abnormality. She writes, I carried my baby for about 4 more months. One close friend put together a prayer circle instead of a baby shower. After Chloe was born, she hung on for 7 hours. The hospital let me sleep with her, and that time was very precious to me. My doctor said the hospital held a seminar on how our baby's delivery was handled so that they could help others who made our choice in the future. Our baby ended up inspiring a number of people, which I never expected. Well, finally, let's take a moment to note the passing of singer-songwriter Kenny Rankin. One of his most popular songs has given a lot of people solace over the years. As we listen to Peaceful, let's remind you that you can always contact us. Just go to hereandnow.org, click on Contact Us, or leave a comment.
And it's all so peaceful here. No one bending over my shoulder. Nobody breathing in my ear. Ooh, oh, so peaceful, oh, so peaceful, oh, so peaceful here.
Back in 30 seconds, here and now. 88-year-old James von Brunn wrote in his journal, "The Holocaust is a lie. Obama was created by Jews." This week, the lifelong racist was charged with murder in the shooting death of a guard at the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. The week before, Dr. George Tiller was killed in his church, witnesses say by a man who expressed hate for abortion providers. In April, the Department of Homeland Security warned of an upsurge in right-wing extremism that was reminiscent of a time just before the Oklahoma City bombing, and the department was vilified by conservatives for that report. But according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, the number of hate groups in America has jumped to nearly 1,000. That's a 54% increase since the year 2000. And according to the federal government, after the November election, President Obama received more threats than any other president-elect in history. Well, joining us on the line from the Southern Poverty Law Center in Montgomery, Alabama, is Mark Potok, director of the Intelligence Project, which tracks hate activity in America. Mark, is, in your view, the rise in hate crimes maybe ironically connected to the election of President Obama, which many people saw as a sign of tolerance?
Well, it's, I think, too soon to say, you know, how much has that affected this movement. But it's very clear that in the last 6 or 7 months that there really has been a major reaction on the right, on the white supremacist right, not only about the idea of a black man in the White House, but also about the idea that whites will lose their majority, according to the Census Bureau in the United States, along about the year 2042.
Well, we want to be careful to clarify here. You said the right and the white supremacist right. Were you trying to clarify? I mean, do you mean the political right or the white supremacist right?
Well, I think there have been backlashes to the Obama election, both from relatively mainstream America, a real subsection of the white population, and then, of course, from the real radical right, the white supremacist right.
Well, as you well know, conservatives objected vehemently to the Homeland Security report. The chair of the Republican National Committee said it was an attempt to label people with different philosophies than the Obama administration as terrorists, and that Homeland Security was somehow quashing a freedom of speech on the right.
I think that the reaction from the commentators, from figures in the Republican Party and so on to the DHS report was absolutely bogus. It was hogwash. If somebody actually sat down and read the DHS report, it was, in fact, a perfectly sober and reasonable assessment of what is actually going on out there.
And why do you think this is happening? Paul Krugman in today's New York Times says the extreme right-wing media is partly to blame. He mentions the actor John Voight as well, an outspoken critic of the Obama administration, who spoke at a Republican fundraiser earlier this week, saying, among other things, that we need to free this nation from the Obama oppression. And he goes on with this list. Let's listen.
And let's give thanks to all the great people like Sean Hannity, Rush Limbaugh, Bill O'Reilly, Laura Ingram, Mark Levin, William Bennett, Glenn Beck, Hugh Hewitt, Dennis Prager, Michael Medved, Dennis Miller, Dick Morris, Ann Coulter, John Kasich, Michael Steele, Karl Rove, Newt Gingrich, Thomas Sowell, Victor Davis Hanson, Shelby Steele, Charles Krautheimer, Michelle Malkin, Fred Barnes, and so many others. Let's give thanks to them for not giving up and staying the course to bring an end to this false prophet, Obama.
John Voight speaking at a Republican fundraiser this week with a sort of a who's who in the conservative firmament. But Bill O'Reilly, for instance, called Dr. Tiller the baby killer, saying Tiller had blood on his hands. Does Krugman have a point? Can you draw a line from hot language to hate crime?
I think you can. I think Krugman's point is absolutely correct. The large number of people on the list that John Voight read in that clip are, in fact, people who routinely lie, who lie on the national airwaves, who tell complete falsehoods.
Give an example.
Well, you know, when Glenn Beck, for instance, ruminates about FEMA running a string of secret concentration camps in which to slam good Americans. You know, that is a conspiracy theory drawn right out of the militia movement. When a character like Lou Dobbs gets on national television and reports as fact the idea that Mexico is secretly planning to invade the United States and reconquer the American Southwest, or that Mexican immigrants are bringing an epidemic of leprosy here, these are complete falsehoods.
Where are you seeing a rise in hate crimes?
Well, the most noticeable and I think proven rise in hate crimes that has occurred out there has been in anti-Latino hate crimes. The FBI national statistics show a 40% rise in anti-Latino hate crimes between 2003 and 2007. That rise precisely falls in the period in which we hear on the airwaves the kind of mainstreaming of anti-immigrant extreme rhetoric.
And what kind of crimes are you seeing? I'm thinking of reports from New York's Long Island of immigrants who were beaten. You know, be more specific.
Well, in Suffolk County in Long Island, a man was stabbed to death by a group of teenagers who had gone, quote-unquote, beaner hunting.
Beaner?
But, you know, but that was one of many similar crimes.
What did that mean to them, beaner?
It's an epithet for Mexicans. Huh. And, you know, they later told police that this was something they did regularly. They went out and beat up Mexicans.
And you also have seen hate groups rising 54% since 2000. Are you seeing more violence from those groups or from, you know, groups of teenagers on the periphery of these groups?
They may or may not be actual members of these groups. But, you know, we have had just in the last couple of months five law enforcement officers, not including the guard who was killed at the Holocaust Museum, murdered by people with radical right-wing views.
Give me one example of those, because I know
A man named Richard Poplawski is accused of murdering three Pittsburgh police officers. They came to his house in some kind of domestic dispute between him and his mother. He was standing behind his mother wearing a bulletproof vest, stepped out from behind her and gunned them down. Turns out this guy had been, for a long time into the ideas of, you know, the Jews are taking over the world, they've got to be fought, and so on.
Mark Podock, where do you think we're headed with this? How bad do you think it's going to get? And what can or should be done?
Well, I fear that it could get worse before it gets better. We're seeing, in a sense, a kind of perfect storm of factors that favor the continued growth of these groups. And those factors are continuing relatively high levels of non-white immigration, the election of Obama, and the coming in of a relatively liberal administration, and the crashed economy. All of those things could and probably are contributing. You know, what can be done? I think, you know, one of the main things that we can do as a society is to be aware of what is going on out there, and particularly to be aware of the kind of mainstream commentators who are continually pumping out into the public alleged facts that are, in fact, completely false.
Well, and what about being aware of people like James Von Brunn? Your organization had been tracking him for years. He spent 6 years in prison for trying to kidnap members of the Federal Reserve Board at one point. How is it that he is still armed with a shotgun, allegedly? And
well, he shouldn't have been. I mean, he was a convicted felon. There is a law against that, right? I mean, we really don't need to pass more laws to prevent the Von Brunners of the world from having weapons. Additionally, obviously, there are thousands and thousands of people who come out of the prisons every week, and law enforcement cannot be asked to sort of trail every one of them. I mean, not only is that not practical, but it's obviously unconstitutional as well. You know, and one cannot be put into prison in this country because you have unpleasant views.
Mark Potok, director of the Intelligence Project at the Southern Poverty Law Center in Montgomery, Alabama. Mark, thanks so much.
And thank you for having me.
Okay, in a minute, a side of Carl Sandburg you might not know. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back.
When Abraham Lincoln was shoveled into the tombs, he forgot the copperheads and the assassins in the dust, in the cool tombs.
Did you know that poet Carl Sandburg was also a folk singer?
Oh, the bull weevil lamb, a little black bug come from Mexico, they say.
That there are photos of him with his guitar serenading Marilyn Monroe at a Hollywood party. This is a recording from the 1950s from a record called The Great Carl Sandburg Songs of America. It's of Sandburg singing bull weevil and playing the guitar, which is where our next guest comes in. That's Ken Lellen, and he owns a guitar that Carl Sandburg once owned and played, and one which opens a window on a fascinating part of Carl Sandburg's life, his relationship to a Los Angeles-based music critic named Mildred Norton. Ken Lellen performs at retirement centers and churches along the East Coast, playing tunes from the 20s, 30s, and 40s on vintage guitars, and he joins us in the studio with Carl Sandburg's. Ken, welcome.
Thank you.
Before we talk about this guitar, which you have right in front of us, remind us about Carl Sandburg, the folk singer. When did that start?
He did poetry readings in the 19-teens into the 20s, and around that time he started adding a guitar at the end of his poetry readings. He even wrote back to his wife around 1919 saying, "I'm bringing home a loud and monstrous device called a guitar." And he began collecting folk songs around that same period, which he assembled ultimately into a book, The American Song Bag, which is a collector's item in its own right.
As is this guitar that you're holding. Tell us about this particular guitar.
This is a 1933 Martin OM-18 orchestra model, sold for $60.
And we know that Carl Sandburg bought it because the provenance of this guitar opens up a whole story. You mentioned Carl Sandburg was married, but he apparently also had a deep friendship with a woman in Los Angeles who was with him when he bought this guitar. Tell us.
He had friendships with women in many different cities. He had a lady friend in Los Angeles and was with him in 1957-58 when he went to go buy a guitar at a pawn shop on Spring Street. Her name, Mildred Norton. She was there when he bought it. He wrote a check to the pawn shop owner, and as he handed it to the guy, the man looked up and said, "Oh, for a moment I thought you were the famous poet."
And she smiled and nodded, "He is." Who was she?
Mildred Norton was a classical music critic for the Los Angeles Daily News in the 40s, 50s, and into the 60s.
And she said he left this guitar with her, presumably not to schlep it back and forth across the country.
And in fact, he tried to talk her into getting lessons, which she never really did. But she kept it even after he passed on in 1967.
And with the guitar comes all sorts of cards that they exchanged, photographs. There is a photograph of Carl Sandburg sitting on a couch at a party in Hollywood with a sort of curled up kitten-like Marilyn Monroe chatting with him.
It's part of a series of photographs that were taken at several Hollywood parties with him with a guitar in his arms with Marilyn on one side and Mildred on the other.
There are also, as we said, postcards. I'm looking at one now that's been printed out here. It's to Mildred Norton from Carl. He writes, "Who can write birthday poems? Who knows how to write one to live with? Who can fashion forth line after line with changing time beats and sweet cartoons?" Am I reading that correctly?
Yep.
"You're good, very special, good, and I always told you so, and I expect to tell you so again, should you be willing to listen." And you have another one there. Would you read that for me?
He called her by a sweet name, a pet name, "Dear Mibs. One of these days, you should know, I'm going to write you the longest letter you ever had written to you. It will consist of facts and prophecies and music which will linger in your excellent and sensitized ears. Yours, Carl."
Well, and one of the reasons we're mentioning the cards and the letters and the pictures is that they all, as we said, are part of the provenance of the guitar. Are you selling the guitar?
I am now. I picked it up a couple years ago. I traded 5 guitars and a small pile of money. I thought there was unrealized potential in the instrument. It's more than just a guitar, and it's more than just love letters between Carl and Mildred.
And does it feel any different to you because Carl Sandburg played it? I mean, you entertained.
I've owned about 125 vintage guitars, and they're all special in their own little way. They all have character and color and tone. This does, too. This has a big, robust tone that you can only get from a 75-year-old Martin.
Yeah. And what do you think of Carl Sandburg, the folk singer? Should he have stuck with poetry? or was he good?
He was very good. He was like a journalist by collecting folk songs. He assembled a piece of America with those songs.
You bought this guitar because you thought as a collector it was an important item, and you are a guitar collector, but were you also aware of his poetry? I mean, you can hardly be American and not be aware of the fog rolling in on Cat Feeder.
His poetry is a lot more than that one little snippet of 8 lines. That cat snipping in on the fog is an 8-line poem that gets overrated. He had a lot of other poetry. We are waiting for the day that someone comes back and reclaims his poetry as important in America. That has not happened lately. People are more interested in his biography. He was a journalist, a muckraker in the teens and 20s in Milwaukee and Chicago. He was a biographer of Lincoln. He was a vagabond. He was a consultant to movies. He had several children who were in and out of talking bases with him. So he had a life like any other man or woman that we see in America. Interesting character in a lot of ways.
Complicated.
Yes.
Yeah. Can you just play us a snippet of something that you would think speaks to Carl Sandburg, poet/folk singer?
No one to talk with, all by myself. No one to walk with, but I'm happy on the shelf. Ain't misbehaving, I'm saving my love for you. I know for certain the one I love. I'm through with flirting, you I'm thinking of. Ain't misbehaving, honey, I'm saving my love for you.
Ken Lellon, playing the guitar once owned by Carl Sandburg, now offering it up to the public. Are you going to be sad to let it go?
No, I've owned, as I said, about 125 guitars. I currently have a couple of dozen. I love playing them. I hold them for a couple of years and let go of them. They're precious. They're beautiful. They sound unlike anything you can get with an electrical appliance today. When the electricity goes off, they still make music.
Yeah. So let them go.
Yep.
Ken, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.